H.P. Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Read and performed by William E. Hart. Chapter 2. An Antecedent and a Horror. 5. The probability that Kerwin was on guard and attempting unusual things, as suggested by the odd shaft of light, precipitated at last the action so carefully devised by the band of serious citizens. According to the Smith Diary, a company of about 100 men met at 10 p.m. on Friday, April 12th, 1771, in the great room of Thurston's Tavern at the sign of the Golden Lion on Weybosset Point across the bridge. Of the guiding group of prominent men, in addition to the leader John Brown, there were present Dr. Bowen, with his case of surgical instruments, President Manning without the great periwig, the largest in the colonies, for which he was noted, Governor Hopkins, wrapped in his dark cloak and accompanied by his seafaring brother Essex, whom he had initiated at the last moment with the permission of the rest, John Carter, Captain Matthewson, and Captain Whipple, who was to lead the actual raiding party. These chiefs conferred apart in a rear chamber, after which Captain Whipple emerged to the great room and gave the gathered seamen their last oaths and instructions. Eleazar Smith was with the leaders as they sat in the rear apartment awaiting the arrival of Ezra Whedon, whose duty was to keep track of Kerwin and report the departure of his coach for the farm. About 10:30, a heavy rumble was heard on the great bridge, followed by the sound of a coach in the street outside, and at that hour there was no need of waiting for Whedon in order to know that the doomed man had set out for his last night of unhallowed wizardry. A moment later, as the receding coach clattered faintly over the muddy dock bridge, Whedon appeared, and the raiders fell silently into military order in the street, shouldering the firelocks, fowling pieces, or whaling harpoons which they had with them. Whedon and Smith were with the party, and of the deliberating citizens there were present for active service Captain Whipple, the leader, Captain Essex Hopkins, John Carter, President Manning, Captain Matthewson, and Dr. Bowen, together with Moses Brown, who had come up at the 11th hour though absent from the preliminary session in the tavern. All these freemen and their 100 sailors began the long march without delay, grim and a trifle apprehensive as they left the muddy dock behind and mounted the gentle rise of Broad Street toward the Pawtuxet Road. Just beyond Elder Snow's church, some of the men turned back to take a parting look at Providence lying outspread under the early spring stars. Steeples and gables rose dark and shapely, and salt breezes swept up gently from the cove north of the bridge. Vega was climbing above the great hill across the water, whose crest of trees was broken by the roof line of the unfinished college edifice. At the foot of that hill, and along the narrow mountain lanes of its side, the old town dreamed. Old Providence, for whose safety and sanity so monstrous and colossal a blasphemy was about to be wiped out. An hour and a quarter later the raiders arrived, as previously agreed, at the Finner farmhouse, where they heard a final report on their intended victim. He had reached his farm over half an hour before, and the strange light had soon afterward shot once into the sky, but there were no lights in any visible windows. This was always the case of late. Even as this news was given, another great glare arose toward the south, and the party realized that they had indeed come close to the scene of awesome and unnatural wonders. Captain Whipple now ordered his force to separate into three divisions. One of 20 men under Eleazar Smith to strike across to the shore and guard the landing place against possible reinforcements for Kerwin until summoned by a messenger for desperate service. A second of 20 men under Captain Essex Hopkins to steal down into the river valley behind the Kerwin farm and demolish with axes or gunpowder the oaken door in the high, steep bank, and the third to close in on the house and adjacent buildings themselves. Of this division, one-third was to be led by Captain Matthewson to the cryptical stone edifice with high, narrow windows, another third to follow Captain Whipple himself to the main farmhouse, and the remaining third to preserve a circle around the whole group of buildings until summoned by a final emergency signal. The river party would break down the hillside door at the sound of a single whistle blast, then waiting and capturing anything which might issue from the regions within. At the sound of two whistle blasts, it would advance through the aperture to oppose the enemy or join the rest of the raiding contingent. The party at the stone building would accept these respective signals in an analogous manner, forcing an entrance at the first, and at the second descending whatever passage into the ground might be discovered, and joining the general or focal warfare expected to take place within the caverns. A third or emergency signal of 3 blasts would summon the immediate reserve from its general guard duty, its 20 men dividing equally and entering the unknown depths through both farmhouse and stone building. Captain Whipple's belief in the existence of catacombs was absolute, and he took no alternative into consideration when making his plans. He had with him a whistle of great power and shrillness, and did not fear any upsetting or misunderstanding of signals. The final reserve at the landing, of course, was nearly out of the whistle's range, hence would require a special messenger if needed for help. Moses Brown and John Carter went with Captain Hopkins to the riverbank, while President Manning was detailed with Captain Mathewson to the stone building. Dr. Bowen, with Ezra Whedon, remained in Captain Whipple's party, which was to storm the farmhouse itself. The attack was to begin as soon as a messenger from Captain Hopkins had joined Captain Whipple to notify him of the river party's readiness. The leader would then deliver the loud single blast, and the various advance parties would commence their simultaneous attack on 3 points. Shortly before 1 a.m., the 3 divisions left the Fenner farmhouse, one to guard the landing, another to seek the river valley and the hillside door, and the third to subdivide and attend to the actual buildings of the Kerwin farm. Eleazar Smith, who accompanied the shore guarding party, records in his diary an uneventful march and a long wait on the bluff by the bay, broken once by what seemed to be the distant sound of the signal whistle and again by a peculiar muffled blend of roaring and crying and a powder blast which seemed to come from the same direction. Later on, one man thought he caught some distant gunshots, and still later, Smith himself felt the throb of titanic and thunderous words resounding in upper air. It was just before dawn that a single haggard messenger with wild eyes and a hideous unknown odor about his clothing appeared and told the detachment to disperse quietly to their homes and never again think or speak of the night's doings or of him who had been Joseph Kerwin. Something about the bearing of the messenger carried a conviction which his mere words could never have conveyed, for though he was a seaman well known to many of them, there was something obscurely lost or gained in his soul which set him forevermore apart. It was the same later on when they met other old companions who had gone into that zone of horror. Most of them had lost or gained something imponderable and indescribable. They had seen or heard or felt something which was not for human creatures, and could not forget it. From them there was never any gossip, for to even the commonest of mortal instincts there are terrible boundaries. And from that single messenger the party at the shore caught a nameless awe which almost sealed their own lips. Very few are the rumors which ever came from any of them, and Eleazar Smith's diary is the only written record which has survived from that whole expedition which set forth from the sign of the Golden Lion under the stars. Charles Ward, however, discovered another vague sidelight in some Fenner correspondence which he found in New London, where he knew another branch of the family had lived. It seems that the Fenners, from whose house the doomed farm was distantly visible, had watched the departing columns of raiders, and had heard very clearly the angry barking of the Kerwin dogs, followed by the first shrill blast which precipitated the attack. This blast had been followed by a repetition of the great shaft of light from the stone building, and in another moment, after a quick sounding of the second signal ordering a general invasion, there had come a subdued prattle of musketry followed by a horrible roaring cry which the correspondent Luke Fenner had represented in his epistle by the characters This cry, however, had possessed a quality which no mere writing could convey, and the correspondent mentions that his mother fainted completely at the sound. It was later repeated less loudly, and further but more muffled evidences of gunfire ensued, together with a loud explosion of powder from the direction of the river. About an hour afterward all the dogs began to bark frightfully, and there were vague ground rumblings so marked that the candlesticks tottered on the mantelpiece. A strong smell of sulfur was noted, and Luke Fenner's father declared that he heard the third or emergency whistle signal, though the others failed to detect it. Muffled musketry sounded again, followed by a deep scream less piercing but even more horrible than those which had preceded it, a kind of throaty, nasty plastic cough or gurgle whose quality as a scream must have come more from its continuity and psychological import than from its actual acoustic value. Then the flaming thing burst into sight at a point where the Kerwin farm ought to lie, and the human cries of desperate and frightened men were heard. Muskets flashed and cracked, and the flaming thing fell to the ground. A second flaming thing appeared, and a shriek of human origin was plainly distinguished. Fenner wrote that he could even gather a few words belched in frenzy.
Almighty! Protect my lamb!
Then there were more shots, and the second flaming thing fell. After that came silence for about 3/4 of an hour, at the end of which time little Arthur Fenner, Luke's brother, exclaimed that he saw
a red fog
going up to the stars from the accursed farm in the distance. No one but the child can testify to this, but Luke admits the significant coincidence implied by the panic of almost convulsive fright which at the same moment arched the backs and stiffened the fur of the 3 cats then within the room. 5 minutes later, a chill wind blew up, and the air became suffused with such an intolerable stench that only the strong freshness of the sea could have prevented its being noticed by the shore party or by any wakeful souls in Pawtuxet Village. This stench was nothing which any of the Fenners had ever encountered before, and produced a kind of clutching, amorphous fear beyond that of the tomb or the charnel house. Close upon it came the awful voice which no hapless hearer will ever be able to forget. It thundered out of the sky like a doom, and windows rattled as its echoes died away. It was deep and musical, powerful as a bass organ, but evil as the forbidden books of the Arabs. What it said no man can tell, for it spoke in an unknown tongue, but this is the writing Luke Fenner set down to portray the demoniac intonations.
Dies mis, Jashir, Mother Dosta Faduvama, Enidamas.
Not till the year 1919 did any soul link this crude transcript with anything else in mortal knowledge. But Charles Ward paled as he recognized what Mirandola had denounced in shudders as the ultimate horror among black magic's incantations. An unmistakably human shout or deep-chorused scream seemed to answer this malign wonder from the Kerwin farm, after which the unknown stench grew complex with an added odor equally intolerable. A wailing distinctly different from the scream now burst out, and was protracted ulliently in rising and falling paroxysms. At times it became almost articulate, though no auditor could trace any definite words, and at one point it seemed to verge toward the confines of diabolic and hysterical laughter. Then a yell of utter, ultimate fright and stark madness wrenched from scores of human throats, a yell which came strong and clear despite the depth from which it must have burst, after which darkness and silence ruled all things. Spirals of acrid smoke ascended to blot out the stars, though no flames appeared and no buildings were observed to be gone or injured on the following day. Toward dawn, 2 frightened messengers with monstrous and unplaceable odors saturating their clothing knocked at the Fenner door and requested a keg of rum, for which they paid very well indeed. One of them told the family that the affair of Joseph Kerwin was over, and that the events of the night were not to be mentioned again. Arrogant as the order seemed, the aspect of him who gave it took away all resentment and lent it a fearsome authority, so that only these furtive letters of Luke Fenner, which he urged his Connecticut relative to destroy, remained to tell what was seen and heard. The non-compliance of that relative, whereby the letters were saved after all, has alone kept the matter from a merciful oblivion. Charles Ward had one detail to add as a result of a long canvass of Pawtuxet residents for ancestral traditions. Old Charles Slocum of that village said that there was known to his grandfather a queer rumor concerning a charred, distorted body found in the fields a week after the death of Joseph Kerwin was announced. What kept the talk alive was the notion that this body, so far as could be seen in its burnt and twisted condition, was neither thoroughly human nor wholly allied to any animal which Pawtuxet folk had ever seen or read about.